This is Joseph Culp, Dr. Doom from the original Fantastic Four movie. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome to the Lair, comic book fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. As every comic book fan knows, you can't tell the story of superheroes without a supervillain. Today, I am sitting down with an incredible actor who portrayed the baddest of the bad, the supervillain to top all supervillains, the diabolical Dr. Doom. Joseph Culp is joining me in the lair to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the original Fantastic Four film. Now, most comic book fans recognize Joseph Culp for having worn the cape and mask of the Lord of Latveria and menacing the Fantastic Four, but his last name probably sounds familiar to you for another reason. Take a listen, and I'll be right back to talk to Joseph Culp. Joseph Culp began his acting career on an episode of the ABC television series The Greatest American Hero alongside his father, Robert Culp, who played FBI agent Bill Maxwell. In what turned out to be the series' final episode, entitled Vanity Says the Preacher, Robert was able to cast his son Joseph and just about his entire immediate family in the production. This led to numerous acting opportunities for Joseph, including roles on television in Highway to Heaven, ER, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and a memorable turn as John Hamm's father on Mad Men. He can also be seen on screen in Panther and Apollo 13, and he won acclaim for his roles in the 9/11 drama The Reflecting Pole and Hunger, both of which he produced, and in Hunger, he even got to share the screen one final time with his father. But to this day, fans young and old approach Joseph wanting to know more about the film that wasn't released, The Fantastic Four.
You are pitiful. Half the fun is the chase. You've robbed me of even that. Ah, well. At least you've left me the pleasure of the kill.
Joining me on the show today, all the way from Latveria, is Victor Von Doom himself, Joseph Culp. Joseph, welcome to Comic Book Central.
All the way from Latveria.
The ruler of Latveria. Wow, thank you for flying in today. Hey, what's your opinion? Do you think somebody named Von Doom pretty much has a career path set in place early on?
Yes, I think that anyone named Von Doom pretty much, the path is made straight is for him. Yeah.
There's not too many careers he's not going to be bagging groceries or anything like that.
I just saw something about the reason why Stan Lee or Jack Kirby picked Doom, and it might have been Jack, I'm not sure, or Stan. They said there was something, it was really to represent death. You know, they wanted death to come, which is why he had the hood and everything, and that the suit was metal suit was really to be like a skeleton in a sense. And Doom, he said there was something elegant with a sense of menace about it. Nice. I just like that.
Oh, that's poetic. Well, that's got to be Stan, I would think. Yeah, he's got that purple prose that always works so well for the comics.
Menace. Doom, says it all. You know it's going to be good.
Well, exactly. Well, I tell you what, we primarily want to talk about your work as Dr. Doom on the Fantastic Four movie, which we all love. We'll get to that shortly, but that was not your first time performing in the world of superheroes, I don't believe. Was your first acting gig on the final episode of The Greatest American Hero?
Oh, my goodness. Boy, you do your homework. It was indeed.
Vanity Says the Preacher, I believe, was the episode title. The final episode of season 3, written and directed by...
by my old man, Robert Culp.
Oh, the legendary Robert Culp.
I was a young actor in New York, doing plays and training, and my old man did me a solid, and my brother too, actually.
I've seen this referred to online as the Culp family reunion.
Yeah.
Let's see if I got all this right. You portrayed Roberto Del Vera, also portrayed a young General Del Vera, your own father, in a film reel. So you go back in that. Your brother Jason's in it.
Yes.
You played Francisco Del Vera, your brother. And then in that old newsreel footage, is it your brother Joshua?
My brother Joshua played Bill Maxwell. Played my pop.
And he looks just like him.
He looked more like him than any of us.
That was amazing. And then also your sister plays your wife in a wedding scene.
That's right. God, you're good.
And who else we got here? Is it your stepmother and stepsister and grandmother are also in this party
one
scene?
Shot, yeah, in a party scene or in the screening scene where, that's right, my stepmother, my grandmother, and my half-sister.
Yeah, now how long did it take your dad to get that set together where you shot the party scene? That's all a set, right?
Not very long to put it together because it was his house.
He just woke up and started going to work, right?
Let's just shoot at the house. It was the end of the series. They weren't sure if they were coming back. They probably thought they were, but, you know, and my dad was going to get in his last licks writing and directing on that show. And he crafted that script and got his sons to be in it and shot it in his house. And, you know, it is called Vanity, says the preacher. So it's all a big vein exercise.
He gets everybody in that thing.
First time I got to be on.
How cool is that to star with your dad? And it's not like a cameo. I mean, he wrote some great characters for you and your brother.
Well, it was unusual, you know, and they actually made us come in an audition, believe it or not. Because, you know,
the director didn't have that much pull, right?
It was just, you know, it was a little too nepotistic. it was Ruben Cannon was the casting director then. And we came out to L.A. Jason and I were both studying in New York as actors and working as actors, too. And we came out to L.A. and we actually did a casting set. We had worked on the scenes, you know, tirelessly. And they went, well, okay, I guess you got the part, you know. But we worked on our Spanish accents, you know. We had to perfect those because we were Latin Americans from some country we did not know.
It wasn't Latveria, was it?
It wasn't Latveria, yeah. Sounds a little Latverian, you know, my Spanish and my Latverian kind of mixed up there. But, yes, that was the first time, and that was a superhero show.
It's a very cool episode too. I mean, to talk about super, there's an actual comic book in it, where this country where like they're obsessed with Ralph Hinckley, whatever hero he's playing.
El Caballo Rojo. That's right.
The Red Stallion. Did you ever see the comic book though?
I did see it.
Do you know? So here's to see if how closely you pay attention to the episode. Is that a real comic book or what's inside?
There's nothing in there. They did the cover.
Right. It's a Spider-Man comic book.
Oh, you know that.
Peter Parker, Mary Jane, and the Vulture. Yeah, I was looking at that freeze frame thing, and it's like, it's a Spidey comic.
You can see that it's a Spidey comic.
Yeah. You can see it.
So they just took a Spider-Man and put the yellow the wig on.
Yep, the Red Stallion. The cover they did the cover, but then
did the cover. Okay.
Right, when Connie Selica as Pam flips the book open to read it.
It's Spider-Man.
It's a Spider-Man comic book, yeah. But your dad, I think, cut away quickly enough that you can't really tell unless you freeze frame. No. And who was freeze framing, you know, VHS back then?
You are, obviously.
Apparently I was, yes.
Apparently you.
Really cool episode, though. I mean, and very deep. I mean, it's really politically charged. You kind of address that. Even the characters in the episode address that. Some deep things going on.
You know, God love him. You know, he always, when he decided to write a piece of television, you know, he was always reaching for something on the feature level, you know. They were like little movies to him. And from the I Spy episodes that he wrote to the Greatest American Hero stuff, they were always like these little feature films within the context of the show. And he took on, you know, an idea, either that was about, you know, the political coups in South America and how, you know, U.S. was involved and in various ways. It was metaphoric of that. He always went for a high-minded idea, which is pretty cool.
Was there anything in particular that inspired him for that episode?
You know, it's a good question. I think he was, you know, that was the early 80s. A lot of stuff was coming out about El Salvador and Nicaragua at that time. And I think, you know, there was rumblings about, you know, CIA involvement and so forth, and how, you know, these coups would either be set up or would fail accordingly. And I don't doubt that he was thinking about that during that time.
Yeah, and he also included an interesting coda there with the little green guys. He was always talking about the little green guys. They kind of fixed everything up for him.
Well, that was always that was the conceit of the show, is that finally, you had this, you had these aliens out there who were somehow controlling Ralph through the suit or, by the presence of the suit. And that they offered a certain perspective on, current events. Like, it's like day the earth stood still. It's like, what would happen? They finally showed up. I just saw the other day that they come up with a number of something like 40 billion possible Earth-like planets out there.
Wow.
In our galaxy. 40 billion. Okay, a billion is a lot. You talk about 40 billion, and there's got to be some folks out there like us doing a show right now on one of those planets,
doing a podcast episode right now as the little green guys sit behind the microphone.
The little green guys are doing their thing. They're doing it about the greatest American hero.
What did you think about the series itself? So, I mean, obviously it was huge at the time, and your dad, what a iconic role as special agent, FBI special agent Bill Maxwell.
It's sort of like if Kelly Robinson from I Spy had, aged, 20 or 30 years and turned into a curmudgeonly, FBI guy. That's what Bill Maxwell was. It was sort of this ongoing development of my dad's persona as a, as a Fed, basically.
Such great delivery, too. He had
one of the things that people don't always associate or forget about my father was that, he really had a great flair for comedy. Even though you think of him as just a serious actor in a way from a lot of things, he was very funny and he understood irony really well. And he was a good writer. So all of that went into his characterization of Bill Maxwell.
What did he think about the premise of the show? I mean, did he like being on it?
I don't know if I can speak completely for him anymore. My memory is he would say things to the effect of, I think it started out, he thought it was maybe a bit silly, but then it caught his imagination and he wanted it to be even bigger than it was. I think, he really took it by the horns. I think Bill Catt, on the other hand, often thought of it as a little bit, silly right all the way through and didn't enjoy it as much as my dad. I think my dad really enjoyed it and definitely put all of his, trademarks in it. So, I think he liked it a lot.
Well, I have to ask, you mentioned trademarks on it. Did he really eat dog biscuits on the show?
Sure, he did dog biscuits, yeah.
Was that his idea?
We've all eaten dog biscuits. I think they were on the set and found them, and he went, hey, how about this? That's right.
That's a classic. It's so classic. Well, I mean, you obviously had a solid acting coach early on. What did you learn from your father? Because one of your first acting gigs, we said, working with him as a director. What was he able to teach you so early on that you've been able to carry with you through your acting career?
It was fortunate that he gave me that little initiation into the world of, episodic TV, which I haven't really done as much as my feature work, I would say. But, acting in front of a camera with the whole crew and the whole thing for the first time, I'd been doing, little movie projects for years, ever since I was a kid. But, now it was the professional game. And I think it was a relatively painless experience working with him, but it really wasn't because he was under a lot of pressure and he expected a hell of a lot from me, and didn't cater one iota to the fact that I was this green kid, I was there as a professional. So my brother actually has a wonderful tape that he made many years ago of all the outtakes from the dailies of my dad either cursing at somebody or calling for another take. Or, and I remember one classic moment where I was in the shot, I was doing the scene, and I was doing my method actor best, you know. And at one point, I could hear him off camera go, "Don't look at the floor, look at me." I was doing my, like, Brando James Dean thing. It was like, don't do that, you know. Look straight at the actor. You're on television. Do it, you know. So he was pretty hard-nosed about it.
Was it almost like Bill Maxwell yelling at, you know.
I was, just of course. He was half my father, you know, part or third something else, you know. This whole director, you know. He was, you know, he meant it with love, and he wanted to do a good job, and I did too. What do I carry with, you know, I don't know. I mean, I trained for many years with a lot of different teachers. But from my dad, you know, my dad had a lot of style. He had great conviction. You know, I think he understood acting very intuitively, very, very simplistically in a way too. You know, I think he understood, you know, planting your feet, as Jimmy Cagney used to say, you know, plant your feet in front of the guy, look him in the eye and mean it, you know. That's what was the old Cagney expression about acting. And I don't know, I think my dad understood that very well and tried to communicate that to me.
And you get to work with him one other time, fortunately, before he passed away. It was a film called Hunger.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that project?
Well, that's fascinating because that was the shoes on the other foot. You know, I was starring and producing in this little guerrilla indie film based on the famous novel by Knut Hamsun, Hunger, from 1890, and our modern adaptation on the streets of Los Angeles. And I had an actor set for the role of the producer, who was the figure in the movie that had power over my character, who was this homeless writer. So I lost the actor who was going to play the very important role, the producer in Hunger. And I lost him because he fell down a flight of stairs and was in the hospital. And I didn't know where to turn. So I found myself a day away from shooting. I only had the location for a few hours at this studio over in Hollywood. So I picked up the phone. I called my old man. And, you know, I said, listen, I got this problem. I need an actor and I need you. And it was very apropos somehow that I was calling him, because the role of the producer in Hunger is, well, you know, there's the whole power kind of issue between the producer and the writer. And this was the father and son now. So I said, listen, come. I need you on this day. And he said, he hemmed and hawed, you know, And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I got other things. Your sister, I got to go to her school for a yard sale. And I said, come. And I got very testy, you know, which I didn't do too much with my old man, but I did it a few times. And I said, listen, in a tone that he would have used with me at times, it's one day that I need you. And he went, all right. Back the fuck off. Just like, and so we sat there in silence for a moment. I waited. He waited. Well, fax me over the scenes. So I faxed him over the scenes. And he called me back about 20 minutes later. He goes, all right, when is this? when do I have to be there? I said, 1 o'clock. And he came on the day, on a Saturday. He came in and he shot the two scenes that he appears in Hunger with me. And they're really two of the finest scenes in the film, because they say so much about Hollywood. And he played this furious sort of producer character that he was far greater than anybody I could have hired, of course, you know.
He was just getting into character when you were hiring him, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was the character. I knew that he could play it instantly.
Oh.
And I'm the lowly writer who's very humble and asking for an advance on this great screenplay that he's going to write, which, of course, he refuses to give. And it's really a very special moment. And that's immortalized, you know, in that film. Is, wow. In a way, kind of my relationship with him is in those scenes.
What a way to come full circle, too. Just, you know, going from that first acting gig on Greatest American Hero to that. Nice little moment there. So that's,
It was a special moment for us.
That worked out.
And then the film, you know, he finally saw it, and he was very, very proud of what I had done. So I felt good about it.
Wow. That's a pretty cool story.
And for anybody out there who wants to, you know, download Hunger or whatever, it's on Amazon VOD. You can download it and look at it, and you will see that scene.
Wow, check it out. So, hey, you want to talk about Fantastic Four?
Yes.
Let's talk like about that. We hear all the time actors saying how much they love to play villains. Is that true in your case?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think I started playing villains when I was like 5. You know, it's like, so what does that mean? It means that a 5-year-old knows that the coolest thing to play is the villain. You know, he's the guy that gets to have all the fun, being all powerful and treacherous and villainous and evil. You know, you get to play the shadow side. And I mean, there are 8mm movies of me running around with my brothers, you know, and I've got a cape on and a hat. And it's like,
oh, already back then.
I started when I was 5, you know. So when Dr. Doom came my way, and I think at that point, now I could be wrong about this, but I don't think I'd played yet. I was only 30 years old, so I don't think I'd played many villains yet. And it came my way, and I was like, well, yeah, you know, this I have to do. This is like a no-brainer. I must do Dr. Doom. And, you know, it was, that was all she wrote. You know, off I went. So, you know, I think I absolutely went for it. I remember recently doing this interview for a documentary they're doing about this original film and telling the story of the audition and all of that, and how I really went for it. I remember saying, this is just crazy enough for me to do. And this is something I remain outspoken about. It's like, you know, I said, there's no way I can do justice to this role unless I go as far over the top as I can take it, and then some, because this guy, he is one of the classic, you know, villains of the genre of all time. I think, you know, if you look through all of literature, you know, in there's going to be, I even saw a list recently of maybe greatest supervillains, and he's number 4, you know. It's like, I'm not sure who should be ahead of him, quite frankly, but, you know, after all, Darth Vader, you know, come on, that's just a pale imitation of Dr. Doom. Dr. Doom predates him by about 25 years or something.
Yeah, it goes back a little bit. So, yeah, and it's a character that refers to himself in the third person, so there's no way to overact.
There's no way to overact. You know, it's like, you know, if anything, and I really admired the director, Ole Sasson, who he, you know, when he saw what I was going to do with it, he said, I want you to do that, and I want you to keep going, because this... he wanted to make it like a comic book, and that was smart because it was a, you know, small scale film, and the more outrageous we could do with the style, the better. Even though it also mixes a very nice family style at the same time, it has humor, it has big villainous antics, it has you know, very sincere drama. That film, you know, it rode the tone very. Very well, I think. Very well balanced, and for me to just, you know, sink my teeth into Doom was the right choice, I think.
Who approached you to do the film?
Well, as I said, I wasn't approached. I was literally called in, like a lot of actors, to audition for the role. You know, I remember recently Mark Sykes, who was part of one of the casting directors on it, with Laura Schiff, showed me. The original sign-in sheets, okay, for the actors who were auditioning for these roles. And there were several interesting actors there, including Mark Ruffalo, who knew, you know, who would eventually be the Hulk, you know. Doom, he was not, and I'm sure he would agree. In any case, I came in, I did it, I said, I can't believe Roger Corman is going to do the Fantastic Four. Is this possible? He'll never spend enough money, which was true. But it didn't matter. I said, I'm the man for this job. And once I had a taste of it, once I read over the material and I went in and did my first reading, it's like sometimes, you know, as an actor, you say, well, I think I know what I want to do here. And then you go in and you do it and go, okay, now I really know I want to do this, you know. And they called me back a second time, I think, and I did it twice.
Did you know the character from the comic books?
You know, I did, but I have to say, as you know, as a young kid, I think I knew Fantastic Four. I knew about Doctor Doom, but I hadn't followed the issues over the years. I gotten out of, you know, being a fanboy to some degree, and so I had sort of forgotten about a lot of it. And when I went to go reacquaint myself with it, it was a lot of fun.
What did you do to do a little homework, to do a little preparation for the role?
I went all out. I got as many back issues as I could find.
Lee Kirby stuff?
The early stuff, yeah. Starting in 62, I think. And, you know, they didn't really get around to explaining his backstory till a few years later, actually.
Right.
And I had to learn about that. That wasn't in the script for the film either. And there was this definite choice that there was an accident, that Doom was burned up. So that whole controversy about how disfigured Doom really was, you know, was debated a bit. But in the script, you know, he was zapped and burned by lightning. So I figured, well, that's it. You know, I'm a burned up guy, and that's part of my vengeance and my rage at Richards and everybody else. So I read through the back issues. I got into it. I started immediately working on my physical life because I was terrified of just being put in this suit and standing there like a big tin can, you know, because that...
Which could happen. I mean, yeah, but that's...
It could happen. You could just stand there. Well, just stand over there. I don't know. I said, man, I've got to reach the audience and reach the movie through my movements, through my voice, and through any kind of physical behavior that I can think of, because that's the only thing I'm going to have after you see Victor no more. With the Victor part of it, you know, the first few scenes, I wanted Victor to seem a little hard-edged, but also sympathetic, something about him that seems sort of almost gentle, and just a hint of the ego and the arrogance that are going to come, you know. And there's like a moment with Reed on the steps when we're outside of our lecture hall, and then there's a moment right when we're doing our experiment, which I put in, and Ole was okay with that, where he won't leave his station. He keeps trying to fix the problem as everything is blowing up. And he says, you know, I will not fail. I will not fail. And there's a kind of, you know, something is in the guy there. You can tell.
There's a desperation in there too.
And there's desperation.
Yeah, I mean, there's this need to be achieving success, but knowing something bad is going to happen.
You know, and that there's something in him that feels dark, you know. Something definitely dark is there. And right before we started the experiment, I pull out a medallion around my neck and I kiss it. And that was just something I wanted to put in, which nobody cares. It was just for me personally, but that has to do with his mother and that she was a gypsy and that he's been involved in the mystic arts. And that's all part of, you know, that was all part of Doom's motivation, was that he wanted to rescue his mother, who was captured by Mephisto and imprisoned in a sort of a hell realm. And
okay, that's what I was going to ask you about. Did you, like, actors are always talking about filling in backstories or filling in little blank spots on the script, so they know how to motivate themselves. You did that with Victor?
I did that with Victor. I wrote an extensive backstory, and I thought about, you know, why he wants to capture this cosmic energy, what he intends to do with it, and it, you know, it all, you know, that was always part of his pursuit, was to reunite with his mother. And that's where I Will Not Fail comes in, and kissing the medallion and a lot of the sort of agony that Doom is in. I think he not only does he have this sort of, you know, crazed revenge hatred for Reed Richards or jealousy, but I think there's this other part of him that is, you know, is tormented and by the losses of his childhood and, you know, regaining the throne of Laveria and all of that. So I invested a lot in that, to be very honest with you, for my own personal, you know, motivation. I just felt, you know, I want this to be an emotional character. I want him to feel rich and alive. And then I just want to marry that with the physical life, the gestures, the grand posing, the, you know, everything I could think of about, you know, how he dealt with his body in space, as well as even a touch of sensuality, which I thought, you know, it's a little bit creepy, but I thought, you know, how does he feel about being in this suit? You know, I think he likes it. I think that there's something, you know, that he gets pleasure from it. And there's a few moments where he, you know, one part I palpate the throat of Dr. Hauptmann, you know, as which you do in Chinese medicine, actually. So it shows that Doom might know something. He looks under his eyes and even touches his face a little suggestively, you know.
So, yeah, it's a weird, it's a very creepy scene.
It's I mean,
you talk about disturbing Dr. Doom. I mean, you nailed it on that one.
And he does the same thing with...
Did the actor, did he know, like, what you were going to do, or what, did you block that out ahead of time, or did you just, like, let's riff? Yeah.
I totally improvised it in the moment. And the actor was like, ah. And Ole didn't say cut. He said, go for it. I don't know what he's doing, but it looks good, you know. So
looks like Doom.
Yeah, it was just wanting, you know, it wasn't meant to be, you know, sexual per se. It was really meant to be sensual about a guy in an iron suit. You know, how does he express that part of himself? Is it just shut off? You know, I don't think so.
Well, and everything physical has been taken away from him too in the accident. Yeah. So all he has is a tin can.
He has a tin can to work with. So right. If he wants to touch another human being, it may look a little strange, you know.
Well, you pulled it off. You pulled off the challenge.
Wow, thank you.
Did the Kirby art help you out in any way? Because you talked about some of those flourishes and the cape. You see that in the movie where you're just like whipping the cape around or those positions that you're in, like with, you know, the outstretched arm and things like that. Did the comic book art kind of help? Did you look at those and say, that's the pose I want to strike?
Absolutely. You know, I worked for, you know, all the time I had before we started shooting. I went into a theater space. I worked on my voice. Worked on the lines over and over and over to find different types of, you know, meaning behind them, and worked on the physical form because I knew I was going to have this big clunky suit on, you know. So I looked at Kirby's art and I said, you know, I got to have this panache, you know, this grand posing that he does, these imperious, you know, pointing of his fingers, his hands, and I tried to copy them. Quite frankly, because I wanted, you know, for better or worse, I wanted to honor what I saw in this great comic that was legendary. And I didn't want to make it cool. You know, I didn't want it to be, how shall I say, you know, well, a little more like the way it was. Eventually, when they made the big budget films, the Doom was characterized very modern and kind of cool and casual. And this is not a casual character.
Right.
He ain't casual, man. He's going to take over the world and he's going to kill you, you know?
Yeah.
And he's a brilliant scientist and he's such an egotist, you know, that I think it's right to show this epic sort of style that he has. And I absolutely just went with the drawings and tried to physicalize them.
I thought it was a kind of a cool touch, too, and not that it was intended in the script, but, I mean, we always, you know, wonder, like, this animosity he has toward Richards. Well, it, you know, Richards isn't the one that saves him. I mean, he doesn't do anything to lift a finger to help him, and it's Ben Grimm that comes in and knocks him out of the way, but Richards just kind of sits there and watches him fry. So,
well, I tried to put in several places even some additional dialogue about my opinion of Reed Richards, not just that I was jealous of him because, you know, the thing failed and he conquered Colossus and got it, but that I thought Richards was a wimp, you know, and that he was weak and that he didn't try to help me. No, And I just, you know, he's just justifying it because Doom has this narcissistic wound, basically, where he thinks, you know, wants to be better than everybody. But in the last monologue, when they're on the parapet, and he actually is, Reed reaches down to try and hold him. This was not in the script, and they let me rewrite it, just inserting a few additional lines about how he turns the tables at that moment. And Doom says, "I don't need you to save me. You're just weak, and I'm just proving to you how weak you are, you know." And he says, "You see, you do not have the strength to strike the final blow, do you? You know, just as you failed in our attempt 10 years ago." And he, you know, brings it back again. He goes, "Go on, Reed. You still have a chance. Save me." So he's sort of playing with him, even in the last moments where his life, you know, supposedly depends on it. And I think that Doom detaches his hand and lets himself fall.
Yeah, it's a great scene. I mean, it's very cool compelling.
Scene. That last time, I actually really liked that scene. And I was able to, you know, insert those lines to make it a little more juicy, that Doom would even play with Reed and try to have the final, you know, final laugh, which he does.
Oh, it really amps up the tension, too, between those two characters. So, yeah, I mean, it really brings that to
another
life.
Day, he goes. So, yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting character, and I'd love to see him go further, and whoever the next person is to play Doom, you know, that they would try to capture, you know, that complexity, which I think is really in the comic. He's you know, he's wrathful, he's imperious, he's brilliant, he's egotistical. He also has this kind of code of honor, you know, that you'll see occasionally in the comics. Like, he's a man of his word.
Well, he's the leader of a nation. I mean, he's
the leader of a nation.
Yeah, you think about his people. He's always like trying to take care of his people, and he doesn't see, like, any good villain doesn't see themselves as the villain.
He's not. He's a beneficent ruler. He's a, you know, he's anything that he comes up with, or even his reasons for defeating the Fantastic Four have, you know, they have a reason.
Yeah, he's definitely not a two-dimensional character, that's for sure, and you certainly didn't play him that way. Conversations, moments with your co-stars on set, what are some things you remember? Anything jump out that you kind of keep with you all 20 years later?
Oh, my gosh. You know, the coolest moment that I remember, there were a few, but the one that always sticks out to me, and I'll tell it right here, and I know she won't mind, is when I would come out of my little dressing room, you know, these horrible little dressing rooms in Roger Corman's studio over there in Santa Monica, and I put on my suit, and, you know, it hurt, and it was agonizing, and it cut into my skin, and I'd wait right before the shot to secure the mask, of course, so I was just in the suit with my black, like, leotard thing underneath. And when I would come out of the dressing room for to come onto the main stage for some of the scenes, many of the crew and some of the cast would start chanting in the hallway. And they would go, "Doom, doom, 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 doom," like as I was walking, striding down the hall with cape flying, you know. And it was really awesome. And so one time I came out and they started, "Doom, doom, doom." And Rebecca Staub, the beautiful and sexy and wholesome Sue Storm, was standing right there in her little blue spandex outfit. And they started chanting. And I looked at her and I grabbed her and I planted a big kiss right on her lips. And everybody cheered, went, "Yeah!" and "Doom, doom." And I came out to the stage. And she was a bit stunned, I think. And I, you know, she was really cool about it. It was fun, and I'll never forget it.
It seems like you guys had a blast doing this. Obviously, you thought it was going to be hitting theaters or something was going to happen with this. Do you recall getting a call? I think it was the premiere was canceled, and that's how everyone kind of knew that this wasn't going to happen. Do you remember getting a call or from somebody, or how that all – when was the first time you realized, oh, boy, this isn't going to happen?
You know, it's funny. I have to say, that moment is not as clear as, you know, Doom in the hallway with Sue Storm.
Well, of course not.
that moment was, if I know anything about it, if I can remember anything, all I can hear in my head is Ole, the director, calling me personally and saying, look, man, I've got some bad news. They're not going ahead with the release. I was properly, you know, baffled and stunned. We went over, we looked at it over at his house. We watched it, which because I don't think I had seen it yet. And so we got to see it. And I think, I don't know if I was in denial or not, but I think I probably said, well, whatever, they'll figure it out. You know, it'll get released somehow. But what I mean to say is I don't think that I fully believed it until, you know, a year or two went by. It's like, oh, we're really not going to see this movie.
So you held out hope for a while.
I think I thought, like, this is some mishigas. They'll figure out something. It wasn't as clear to me until time had gone by. I heard that the initial premiere and release was canceled. But nobody was getting a really clear story at that point. Certainly I didn't. And, you know, I let it go. You know, I was disappointed, but I think I'm more disappointed in retrospect than I was then. And I mean that really because, you know, an actor just moves on, you know, just like, oh, okay, that's not coming out. I don't know. All right. I didn't have all my hopes pinned on it. It wasn't going to, you know, be, you know, a big moment in my career, although, you know, arguably it might have been a good moment had it been released. What's happened is so ironic that 20 years later, all these fans I have because of this movie, this bootlegged movie that no one has, that everyone's seen but has never been released. I go to Comic-Con and people come up and shake my hand, go, "Your Doom, man, was really solid." And that's like very sweet, you know, maybe bittersweet, but it's ironic, isn't it?
Well, that's what's come up in all of the interviews that we've had with the cast of the Fantastic Four is the fact that this thing got bigger than it ever would have been released. Easily.
Yeah, because it wouldn't, you know, it was a. You know, for the size and the budget of the film, it would have had a little release and, you know, it might have wound up on TV a little more often or something like that. But what has happened has made it kind of a legend rather than.
Right. You think about some of the projects that, you know, Captain America went straight to video. You had The Punisher, which didn't do anything at the box office. And Marvel was struggling at that point. So, yeah, I mean, we're still talking about this one 20 years later.
It's amazing.
And you finally had your premiere, which was really cool. The cast was mentioning about the premiere that you finally had when you got the whole cast together a few years ago.
Yeah.
What was it like to have finally see this with an audience and they're laughing at the right beats and they're clapping and they're Doom, you know, is finally there.
It was tremendous. I got to tell you, it was just like, it was such a kick. You know, we were all there, the director too, all invited to come and do this con and they screened it and there must have been, you know, I don't know, at least a couple hundred people, I guess, in that room. And they were just eating it up. They loved every minute of it. They laughed, they clapped, they cheered. It was fabulous, you know, and it was really, and it wasn't, it, they weren't, it, the laughter was true enjoyment. You know, it wasn't like, oh, this cheesy movie from a long time ago. People really loved what it was, which is a very heartfelt comic book adventure. And it works. It works on pretty much every level, even with its, you know, very challenged special effects. The characters in the story actually come through and you care about the movie you're watching. And that's something, you know, I mean, that's what you want in a movie. Sure, you know, you would have been great to have more CGI and more cool stuff, but the fact that it worked for the audience quite well, their fan audience, and we were making it for the fans too. So it was really a pleasure is what it was. And it was, justice to finally see it with an audience. And, you know, I still hold out hope. I think if anybody has half a brain in their head, they'll eventually release this movie, put it on DVD or whatever for download, or put it on the extras of the next Fantastic Four movie. You know, it's like, you do something with it. It's like it's criminal just to have this film sitting there and people get a kick out of it.
Well, it's on YouTube now. I mean, we can watch. I mean, that's the coolest thing is that we can just go online and watch it.
You can just watch it there.
Have your kids seen it?
Well, you know, further to the irony of the whole thing is that, you know, I had my own bootleg of it for several years and from VHS, and then it became a DVD. And my son, I have a son, grew up probably since the age of three watching this movie. He's a huge, you know, fan of horror, sci-fi, and you know, gaming and everything else. And since he was a little boy, I said, Jackson, this is your father, and this is Dr. Doom. And Dr. Doom became a touchstone for him throughout his entire childhood, from many action figures. He broke off the hand, and I put a piece of Velcro on. And I said, see, now you can do the moment where the hand detaches, you see. And he still has it.
Can act out the final scene.
To act out the final scene. And he would imitate my laugh, you know, my big, whatever, and the lines, and I could hear him in his room doing them. I mean, it was sweet justice, man.
Did you ever use the Doom voice on him to get him to do stuff? Doom commands you to clean the room.
Of course. Jackson, come here. Find them. Find them. He could do the Doom voice as good as me after a while.
Oh, that's got to be a kick as a dad, though. I mean,
it was very cool.
That's got to be worth it all these years later.
That was what was worth it. And, you know, and he grew up to be, he's in college now, but, I mean, he became, you know, a huge fan of, you know, fantasy genre and, you know, Tolkien and you know, he may have always going to be that way. Maybe that was going to be there from the beginning, but I think Doom gave him a lot of permission to kind of love that world, you know, and he may take it, you know, into his career. So, gosh, you know, the karma of these things is hard to figure out, but, you know, it's all good to me.
These characters have been around for over half a century. To what do you attribute the success of the Fantastic Four, the book, the movie, the cartoon, everything?
Well, you know, I think it probably belongs, you know, to the world that has been there for human beings since the dawn of time, which is the world of mythology. And that the great myths, which are all about, you know, life and death, really, and power and interpersonal relationships thereof, you know, acted out on a grand scale, a scale that is fantastic, that is the monstrous, if you will. You know, that's where those ideas become so resonant. You know, when you have, in the case of the Fantastic Four, you've got four, you know, regular people who suddenly become mutants or mutated and have powers, and it's all about their personal psychology. So the powers are a metaphor for their own issues. And then you've got them trying to coexist in a world full of mixed morality. And of course, you're going to go up against, you know, very dark forces. And, you know, how do I attribute the success? It's just the stuff of mythology. It's the stuff of legend. It's Dr. Doom himself, you know, exists as one of the great villains, the way, you know, the Phantom of the Opera or even way back, you know, Herod, the great tyrant kings, Richard III from Shakespeare, you know, attributes. There's a lot of Doom, you know, in that, I think. You know, I think that Lee and Kirby and the whole Marvel gang, you know, that's their genius, is dipping into these archetypal, you know, energies that have been with us since the beginning of recorded history. So, and before that. So that's why, you know, they speak to us still and will continue to speak to us.
There's a lot of comic book themed television shows and movies out now. Any that you like in particular, or if you had a choice, would you like to act or direct or write an episode or anything like that? Anything jump out at you?
Oh, boy. What I love is we're getting a lot more supernatural stuff these days. You know, my daughter's now is watching, you know, American Horror Story, which she really likes, which is pretty creepy. But I like that there's a lot more of the, you know, supernatural stuff going on. And I've always been, you know, since I was a little kid, I was a monster fan and all of that. So I would love to. I just directed a feature in August, which is a more of a comedy drama. But, you know, if the directing path starts to open wider for me, I've got a series I developed about a haunted youth storage facility where there's a different story every week associated with these units. So that has all types of sci-fi and horror in it, and I would write and direct those. I love it. You know, I think you can tell so many wonderful stories when you're beyond the bounds of, you know, normalcy.
Well, somebody, they're always talking about a Greatest American Hero remake. What about, you know, if somebody came up to you having a Culp once again taking on the mantle of Special Agent Maxwell? Would you be interested in something like that? I know, I think even Nathan Fillion said he'd like to take a crack at Ralph Hinckley.
Really, really? How interesting.
What about Joseph Culp and Nathan Fillion? Yeah.
There you go.
On the big screen in The Greatest American Hero. Would you like to play your father's role? Would that be something?
I don't want to pretend to play my father's role. I mean, if they did it again, they would probably reinvent it to some degree. But I'd sure like to be associated with it. I'll tell you what I'd really like. The next time they do a Fantastic Four movie, I'd like them to call me and the other guys up and say, look, we got one scene. We're going to stick you in there as the hot dog vendor, you know, just for kicks. You
know? The old Stan Lee cameo kind of thing.
Yeah, just do a Stan Lee cameo, you know. Yeah. Or be one of Doom scientists or something. I don't know, but I'll be a Doom bot just to complete the whole idiotic circle of things, you know.
Just to put a period at the end of that sentence.
That's right. You know, it's like that would be only just, you know, for, you know, having burned us all those years ago, you know.
Well, you mentioned your co-stars. You worked with your Fantastic Four co-star, Alex Hyde-White, and also your brother Jason, I believe, on the film The Reflecting Pool. I have to say, you can't accuse you of playing it safe as an actor when you take on that one. Tell our listeners a little bit about that project.
Well, Reflecting Pool, you know, I produced and starred in, and it is a investigative drama about the somewhat suppressed facts surrounding 9/11. You know, there's a lot of information out there that is available to people, but that did not get properly investigated during the 9/11 commission, and it points to a lot more people involved in 9/11 than the supposed 19 hijackers. So I'm not pointing any direct fingers because I think more investigation has to happen before that will come out. But there's so many problems with the official story that I decided to go in with this Polish director and spend 3 years of my life making a film about it. It's a powerful film. It's very controversial, but it's a good film because it just introduces information in a fairly gentle way to the greater public that invites them to look a little further. You know, I mean, they're still debating Kennedy 50 years later, and I'd hate to see that happen with 9/11, although it may. 9/11 is still the greatest crime, you know, ever perpetrated on American soil. The fact that it was not properly investigated and that many people were not brought into the 9/11 commission to talk about their part on 9/11 and how such a catastrophic failure could have happened. There are people suffering to this day. I don't want to get heavy, but, you know, families are affected their whole lives from 9/11. There are people who are still sick because of what happened. And it deserves deep, deep investigation, and not by the government, but by, you know, independent panels of scientists.
For those interested in learning more about it, is there a website?
There's a lot of websites out there. I mean, my favorite, certainly you can go to ReflectingPoolFilm.com, which is about our film. But I would go to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, because there are over 2,000 architects and engineers, professionals who have signed on to this thing saying, you know, basically saying that buildings don't fall down like that, not by two planes, and here's why. And that's a wonderful informational website that can teach you a lot about 9/11 that you didn't know.
What is the Walking Theater Group?
Walking Theater Group. Walking Theater Group is a theater group that I've run for, well, going on almost 20 years now. It's just it's basically an experimental theater group that works in a theater in Venice, California, the Electric Lodge. And I give a workshop there on Monday nights where we develop new material for the theater and for films. You learn about acting and writing and developing stuff from the ground up. And we perform as a group and do theater, original stuff. And it started many years ago through a process I helped develop with a psychologist called Walking in Your Shoes, which is a whole other thing that Joseph Culp does. The Joseph Culp that's not the actor, I guess.
Wait a minute. Did you just go third person on me?
Yeah.
As Victor? Did you channel Victor there?
I may have channeled him. You have a problem with that?
I do not.
In addition to being an actor and a filmmaker over the years, I've been involved in developing this sort of a body-mind technique, and people use it all over the world now to learn more about themselves and solve problems. And it's called Walking in Your Shoes, and it deals with the empathy of the body. And people do it in workshops, and they're certified and trained and all that, and they do it. And I'm going to Europe to do some workshops in January. So it's just another thing that I like to do. It's a little more spiritual in a certain sense.
How did you apply Walking in Your Shoes to Dr. Doom? Or was it Doom's boots?
I did apply it. I did several walks of Dr. Doom. When I refer to a walk, it's part of this process where you basically commit to an intention to be someone else.
Kind of living with that character or living in the mind of that character.
You don't imitate or pretend or anything. You actually start to move in the space and you listen to your body and you have an empathic experience as that character or person. And I did several walks as Dr. Doom in the early stages when I was developing the character and, you know, got in touch with issues of confinement and desire for power. And also a kind of, you know, need to suppress others. And that came up quite spontaneously through my walk of using Walking in Your Shoes. And it went into the character. So I like to use it as a foundational thing when I work on roles.
Yeah. What a perfect character to try that out on, too, because I think that was in the early stages of this. So.
Indeed.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, if you go on YouTube, watch Fantastic Four, you see a perfect acting lesson right there because, again, you pulled it off. I mean, you walked in Doom's boots. So good on you.
Walked in the suit. Thanks very much.
Hey, how can fans find out more about you and what you're up to film-wise, television project-wise, appearances?
Yeah. JosephCulp.com is right there. It's pretty much got tons of great clips of all my work. It's got news of new things coming up. As I said, I just finished a feature film, which I wrote, directed, and starred in, called Men's Group, which is going to be quite amusing and hopefully revelatory.
When can we expect to see that? Oh, go ahead. Who's in it?
It's got some interesting character actors in it. Timothy Bottoms, Stephen Tobolowsky, and a host of others. Mackenzie Astin, who's the brother of Sean, actually.
When can we expect to see this?
That's going to be, hopefully will be completed by the spring of 2014 and starting to go out to festivals by the summer.
Great.
And it's called Men's Group, and it is about a men's group.
It's josephculp.com. That's what we want to head to find out more about what's up with the world of Joseph Culp.
Yeah, that you can certainly find out there.
Well, you know what? Not unlike your father's career, you continue to bring us some memorable performances, just like you mentioned there. And 20 years later, this is amazing. We can go online and see how you brought one of our favorite villains to life. We love that. And Fantastic Four. Joseph, thanks for taking some time today to hang out in the Comic Book Central Lair and to chat about some of these cool projects.
Been a pleasure, Joe. Keep in touch. And there's one thing I want to leave you with that Dr. Doom told me to tell you. Here's to the future, my friend.
Oh, come on. How amazing would it be to have a big screen version of The Greatest American Hero with Nathan Fillion as Ralph and Joseph Culp as Agent Bill Maxwell? That's got blockbuster written all over it. And don't forget, the late, great Stephen Cannell, who created The Greatest American Hero television show, appeared numerous times on Castle with Nathan Fillion. And some years ago, it was even reported that Stephen thought it was a cool idea to have Nathan in the red jammies. He said he had a script written. And hey, Fillion supposedly chatted with William Catt, Ralph Hinckley himself, about the project. So you never know, but Nathan and Joseph, that's my dream team for The Greatest American Hero flick. If it happens, you're sure to find out about it on josephculp.com. There you'll find links to everything Joseph mentioned in the interview. Hunger, The Reflecting Pool, The Walking Theater Workshop, the latest on The Men's Group. And you can also check out The Men's Group film on Facebook. Want to learn more about the soon-to-be-released Fantastic Four documentary, Doomed, The Untold Story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four? Head over to the website, doomedthemovie.com. And if you're a new listener to Comic Book Central, welcome to the lair. You can catch up on all of the episodes at our website, comicbookcentral.net, or better yet, subscribe to the show on iTunes. You'll never miss an episode. And if you like the show, please take a moment to give a rating and review on iTunes. My thanks to all who have done just that. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Feel free to like and share The Lair. A lot of great guests are on the way from your favorite comic book-themed movie and TV shows. You don't want to miss an episode. Comic Book Central is also on Twitter, at comicbookctrl. And you can send me your emails, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Next week, I said the month wasn't going to be big enough to contain all of these fantastic guests. Like The Thing, Fantastic Four February bursts through the calendar and concludes with the man who brought it all together. He had the tremendous task of bringing the Fantastic Four to life and only $1 million to spend. The director of the Fantastic Four, Ole Sassone, will be here next week to tell us how he did it. Until then, kids, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Doom, 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 doom.